This is Mr. Henry Anderson in New Sweden, and Mr. Anderson will tell us something about the beginnings of New Sweden. First of all, Mr. Anderson, how old are you?
I am 78 years old.
And your mother was one of the first settlers?
That's right. She was one of the first 51 Swedes that came over in the first party. And it was her little sister that died on the way up, Hilma Klassen. And she died in Florence on the way up, and she was buried on the first Sunday. They came on Saturday, and the little girl was, funeral was on Sunday. So the first official thing they had was a funeral for her on Sunday afternoon, and a large attendance came up even from down Caribou way for the occasion. The very first things that were taken up, of course, after the pioneers arrived on July 23rd in 1870, we probably should mention a few words about how they were recruited in Sweden by W.W. Thomas, who was a war counsel to Sweden appointed by President Lincoln. And he served in this capacity for a number of years in Sweden and got to know the Swedish people very well, and finding out that settlers were not increasing in Maine, he came up with the idea that if he could bring in some people from Sweden or Scandinavians, they were mostly all going west to settle, and so he went and got permit from the state government to settle the township of New Sweden, and so from then on he went to Sweden and recruited these first 51 Swedes, and they all had to pay their passage. There was no money for passage. They were all promised a homestead if they decided to stay on the properties. And these first people arrived by ocean steamers and landed in Halifax, and I remember my mother telling that she was the first of the Swedish party to land on the American soil. One of the people or officer on the boat carried her across the gangway and passed her to another party. She was about 6 years old, and she remembered this very well. So that was part of a little adventure for her. And then they traveled by railroad down to St. John, and from there they were going by a river steamer up to St. John River. But at that time of the year, being in around the 22nd of July, the water was so low, they had to go up by flatboats and horse-drawn riverboats, so that they spent a lot of time coming up from St. John up to Perth, New Brunswick, and there they were housed overnight and slept in a barn, I understand, from what was been told to me. And the next morning they got up early after Thomas had recruited bread and eggs and bacon, and they had a breakfast, and they started out for New Sweden, which he called the Promised Land to his little gang of pioneers. And as they left Perth and come to the heights over Fort Fairfield and could see the Maine, part of Maine, he stopped and pointed out the hills where New Sweden was located, and he said, "Now you can see where the Promised Land is," he said, and because they were all quite excited. And then he stopped and took the American flag and put it on a staff, and he rode at the head of the caravan with the American flag and leading them into United States, into Maine. And in Fort Fairfield at noontime, they were given a nice party with a big lunch or dinner, and they were all welcomed so heartily that they were all very happy when they left Fort Fairfield and traveled on into Caribou. Arriving in Caribou in the late afternoon, they was met by a little town band called Jones's Band, and they marched ahead of the little caravan into town, and they housed them in a big public hall down there, and they also had a supper for them, and they spent the night sleeping in this hall and in probably some homes too. I wouldn't be sure of that, but they spent the night in the caravan. The next morning they got up quite early, 23rd of July, and arrived here shortly after 12, or about 12 noon they arrived at New Sweden. And that was the actual first settlers arriving into northern Maine or New Sweden, and they at this particular time christen their town or their colony New Sweden. And from then on, they separated to be housed. There were six little cabins that the state had built, and they had cleared a few acres of land around each little cabin, and there were 50 people, and one cabin was taken up with supplies, so then there was a little bar shack at the corner of the capital where they could store a few of their articles and the provisions. And the one cabin, I said, was full of food stuff and probably some tools and things for their pioneers. So they had only five cabins, so they 50 people all piled into these five cabins. So they were quite well guided together by finding a room to sleep and so forth. But the very next morning they were up and at it, and had a gathering at the capital lot, and there they decided on different locations, and the lots were drawn for their special locations. And this was done in an unusual way. They were first put into a group of four into each little party, and they were relatives and friends. And then one out of these four pulled a lot for a certain section of four farms. And this went on until they all had, all these representing the four different groups had these pulled apart. And then after that was satisfactory, then the friends and relatives got together, and they pulled lots for each particular lot, these four people in each. And there were still disputes about some of the land. They weren't quite satisfied, so there was, so I've been told, quite an argument about some farmland that this particular person wanted. And it so happened that another man in the same family didn't like his, so they swapped lots, and it all turned out that they were happy with their decisions. And so that was the way it was started, and they planted some turnips the first year and had quite a crop. So that following winter they had a lot of turnips to eat, but that's the only crop they were able to raise that first.
That was in the year 1870?
Yeah, in the fall of 1870. And then in the fall, in the later part of September, they started excavating for the public building, the town hall, which was later called the Capitol. And that was constructed by the pioneers with some help from the state. Where they get the lumber, I'm not sure, but it was all set up on the cedar post of the basement with 7.5-foot clearance, and the building was 30 by 45. It had two offices in the back part, and the main supply base, or a country store, in the front part of it, and then upstairs were the auditorium to meet on. And so this building was up and completed on the outside that first fall in 1870. And so they started using it then during the winter for different gatherings, and the following summer, of course, it was completed, and it was used continuously for pioneers coming. They would house them in the upstairs room for dividing off, and each one would select a corner or a part of that, and their facilities for cooking. There was a stove up in the auditorium. And so it got to be that they called this building the Capitol, and it was, had a cupola on it, which made it kind of outstanding for a community right in the woods, you know. And so that's how, and to this day it's been called the Capitol. And as you know, it was lost by fire last summer in 1971. The last day of June, the lightning struck the town hall and started a fire inside in the walls, and the fire wasn't detected until it was too late to even get into the building to recover any of the contents of the town hall. But the Cable Fire Department came up directly as quickly as you could expect, and they started to try and save the museum, which was located about 20 feet from the town hall. But the intense heat was too much, and the museum finally caught fire, and that burned. But all the contents were saved, and everybody brought the farm trucks, and we loaded the antique materials and collections on the trucks, and they hauled them down to the potato warehouses and drove the trucks in and left them there for a week or two. And then we brought them back up and stored them in the old Capitol School, we call it, which didn't burn, and that's where we have our museum now.
Yes, now, and at first the Capitol was used for public things, such as stories, and a school and church.
Yes, it was used for all town purposes and also for religious purposes. They had services continuously every Sunday from the time the building was constructed. And then in Well, let's see now. It was in 1871, the different churches had organized their own congregations, I was going to say, and the Lutheran Church was constructed and was completed in 1880 at its first 10-year anniversary. So when they had the 10th anniversary of the colony of Sweden, they had a good part of the festivities at the Lutheran Church, and then they marched from here down to the capital, and they had a local band at that time that played for them, and they marched out to the town hall or to the capital, and they had speeches down there, and they come back up and had dedication services here at the Lutheran Church. And this was then the beginning of all the 10-year successive anniversaries. I remember the 30th partly, but the 40th anniversary, I was present in that, and that was my first year that I played in the band at the 40th anniversary, and I played at every anniversary until the 100th anniversary. So we had some big anniversaries. One of the large ones was at the 40th anniversary, and then we had the 90th anniversary. It was quite a big anniversary. The 60th was quite well. Then, of course, the centennial, as you know, was quite an event with pageants, and we had parades and really celebrated our centennial.
That was a highly successful program, set of programs, I think, for the centennial.
You were up for that, yes.
Yes,
yeah. Well, we had a good attendance. It turned out that the weather was almost too perfect. The heat was so intense that some people couldn't come. They couldn't stand the heat, which is unusual for Northern Rustic. But
for a lot of the old celebrations, old Mr. Thomas himself used to come. You remember him?
Oh, yes, I remember him very well. And I can remember seeing him start out, and he'd speak to him, and he'd say, "Mina Banis Gogan." He'd pull his whiskers like this, kind of, and
he kind of opened up. Whiskers.
Yeah, and he called them the children in the woods, and they called him Father Thomas. That's, that was kind of a heritage that stayed with as long as he lived and came here, you know. Plus, the early days in Sweden were a struggle, and clearing land, and it's surprising how fast they get land cleared and new buildings set up. Even in 1900, I can remember from then on quite well, and most of the farmers had new homes and barns and stables and probably herd of cattle, and were planting a few patches of potatoes, not much, but that was looked forward to planting potatoes, of course, but they also planted their own grain, like wheat mostly, and some oats and some buckwheat, and they had a lot of their own flour as a rule, and they got cattle almost very shortly after they came here, and they had their own milk and butter, and that continued on. Of course, in the 1900s, they had a big supply of products, and were self-containing partly by raising their own crops and not depending on potatoes too much, but from then on they started to raise potatoes. The first potato raising, I remember, were done by hand. And they would run out four rows with a little, what we call a marker that had the spacing of the furrows, and the horse would pull that, and that would make four furrows, and then the children and the old people would go and plant the potatoes, and then we had a little fertilizer distributor, it looked like a wheelbarrow with a little box on it, and that would distribute the fertilizer, and then the potatoes were hoed up, and that's the way for many years they were planting potatoes, and then in the fall they had to dig them by hand. I can remember, even though we didn't have such a big acreage, we had some Canadians, French Canadians, come in and stayed. We had three men and a boy, and it stayed at home with us, so I got a great kick out of trying to talk with him, learn some French, and he learned some Swedish. But anyway, that was the custom that all came down. From then on, it was a continuous increase in potato production, and finally the first planters came in, which was quite a novelty, and then the diggers came in, and the first Hoover diggers. Everybody had to see how that works, and finally they all had their own digger, their own planters, and they had a planting increase, and up until the 1930s they were raising a lot of potatoes.
What would the average sized farm be in New Sweden in the 1920s? A typical sized farm?
Well, the land allotted to them was 100 acres, but a lot of them divided the land up and had 50 acres each, and there was quite a few that was only 50 acres each, but they found that was enough for
for their needs. There was families grew up on these farms, and every piece of land was cleared and taken care of and produced nice crops, and they had their barns, of course, and their cattle, and the farming, of course, had its high points in the 40s somewhere, early 40s, it started with tractors coming in, and from then on, farming became more of a problem for the small growers. So, at the present time, they're producing less potatoes now than they did in the 1930s, I believe, in the town of Sweden. One thing that we, of course, had a lot of problems was to notify neighbors and for running with errands. And so I used to be the errand boy from home. I run errands most all the time for grocery stores and to neighbors, and sometimes there was a forest fire got started and they needed to recruit men, and I used to run quite a bit to neighbors and warn them, tell them that they needed help at this particular place, that the fire got out of control and was burning in the woods. And so every time there was a fire, I was almost like an old fire horse. I'd get scared every time there was something going on, and I knew that something wasn't right. And they had a large forest fire that went through and burned one of the mills and a couple of homes. It got started up in the northwest corner, and the wind was right in the right direction, blowing southwest, and it traveled right through the whole swamp, a heavy growth of cedar and spruce, and it all burned right down through a swath of half an acre, well, probably a couple of acres wide, all down through the...
And that wind went out again?
Well, that was before 1890. It was... I meant to say about 1890. It was before the 1900s. See, I started school about 1889, and I was going to a little schoolhouse down where John Thomas Park was, a little country school there, a little red schoolhouse, and that was getting too small, so they discontinued that and moved it down to the B&A section of town, and we went back up and had our school in the Capitol building for a couple of years in the upstairs, and then they renovated the store part in the lower part, and we had our school there for all the time. I went to school afterwards, was in the first story on in the Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of troubles was communication, I was going to say, and I remember the first telephone came up. That was early in the 1900s, of course, and they ran just one line, and of course, interested us kids to see them climb the poles. You know, I can remember that, how fascinated I was how they could climb the poles and get these wires up. And the first telephone exchange was in the old Axel Trinkwitz store down at the corner by the Capitol, and it was later occupied by Bernard Pearson Grocery and General Store. And it was just within a few years, so when we had our 40th anniversary in 1910, the first one that I really remember, I was night operator at a telephone office, and so I had to go down and take my time as an operator down there, and there was a lot of calls come in from the park, and newsmen were calling out and giving news to the different papers, and that was quite a thing, and it wasn't long before everyone in Sweden had telephones. We had a terrific exchange there, and it was busy too, and I think that they had more telephones. In fact, I know they did, and they do now, about 1910 or somewhere on that line. That's the height of that. Other things I kind of remember as a boy was the first cars that came up from Caribou, you know. They came up to there's a post office also in the general store next to the Capitol, and my grandfather was living at the time, so the little horse he used to drive, he was going to train her for not being afraid of the cars, you know. So he held her, and the car would back and forth, and got her used to the car, but I don't think she liked it very well. As far as I could remember, the horses were shy of the automobiles as long as I could remember, until later on when, of course, they got so plentiful that. But these cars were quite something for us boys. We'd always run out to the roadside to see them go by. You know, some were sort of high wheel type, and some were low, and some were steamers, and it was quite interesting. And I also remember when the first drilling machine came in, and it was quite upset by the fellow named Langdon, lived down at the corner. He sold his farm, and he was going to retire and build a house right across from Thomas Park. And this drilling machine came up from Caribou, and as he came up, almost where we are sitting up at Lutheran Church, they put on a new pole, and a big cloud of black coal smoke came up, and we was out in the dooryard down home, and mother was outside, and she started to holler that the church was burning. And of course, I got so scared right off. I thought, here goes the church now, we got to run for help. And Then they blew the whistle, and then we got scared again. Might have thought that was the mill whistle, because the ruling was that just the fire stopped. They'd always blow the mill whistle or ring the church bell or something, you know. And we stood almost like statues there when we seen the smoke, and pretty soon this big machine come pulling along the road and making a lot of noise, and then we didn't know just what it was, but somehow or another we seemed to realize it was a drilling machine or something in that fashion, and of course we had to run up to the road and watch them go by, and that was the first time any drilling machine came into this town, self-propelled, and I don't believe any horse-drawn that I had seen either, I can remember, but...
You mentioned mill.
Do I?
You mentioned a mill.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what mill was this and where was it?
The barn, you mean? What were there for mills? Well, this is quite interesting. There was a lot of smaller mills. I don't remember all of them, but there was a Giverson had a mill, and there was the ones I can remember was Jacob Hedlund Mill and Factory at Templin, and there was a company mill down here at New Sweden called the Ulrich Mill. It was a large potato factory company, and they also had a store, and we called it Ulrich's Mill. And,
that would have been a starch factory?
And there was a starch factory connected with a sawmill and shingle mill, and then we had another sawmill down at the B&A, which was the Trunkus and Johnson sawmill. I can remember that quite well, and they had boarding houses where they used to feed the crew. So these three mills were, the later ones I can remember was this So Trunkus and John Johnson Mill, and then it was the Jacob Hedlund Mill, and then it was the Fred Ulrich, but a company mill, we called it down here at AVR. And the one down at the B&A, I think, was discontinued, and the one up in Templin, I don't remember if that burned or not. It was around for quite a while, but then the Ulrich Mill burned down here, so at one time we had three potato factories in town. Peter Youngreen, a grocery man down at the station, he built a starch factory, and that operated for quite a number of years. And there was a starch factory Templin, one down in Sweden. And the interesting part of some of that was that the potatoes were all graded on the field some days. You know, the men are bigger children, they picked the big ones, only the market size, and we little folks, we had to go behind and pick the small ones, you know, and they were all hauled into the factories in the fall, so the factories were busy grinding these potatoes into starch from the very beginning of digging till late after digging. And that was their income to pay expenses for digging costs, and it was quite a help. I remember how sick we were. We got a few cents to get a pair of new gloves or something for picking potatoes, you know. I remember I got my first pair of cowboy gloves, you know, with a cuff on it, and I thought that was out of this world or something like that. I kept them for a long while. And, well...
When did the B&A branch come in through New Sweden?
They came in the 1900s. Probably 89 to 1900. I remember when they were working on the railroad there, and another thing that I remembered was a long caravan of mules and dump carts came up, and Italians, and they were mostly Italian crews working on railroad construction. They were going from the Sweden up to the northern part to continue on up through into Stockholm, and I had been down to the general store, the Ulrich store, with one of my cousins, and we seen this big train of carts coming there, like a wagon train, and so we ran into a pasture and hid under some bushes, and I was scared to death. I was only about 5 years old, I guess. But I can remember the funny harnesses they had, and the way the saddles were on the mules to carry the weight of the front end of these little carts. These carts were only two wheels. They had a little dump on them so they could shovel them full, and that's the way they worked, mostly handwork and all that railroad construction. And, so they had come up as far as New Sweden, and they moved up and went into Templin up to Stockholm. That's where we saw them go by on the highway, you know. And, shortly after that, the B&A started to run freight and passengers. And I remember some of the first things they did when the railroad was going was take excursions up to Van Buren. That was a regular event during the summer, once or twice, and I was on one of them. And I don't know if I was 6 or 7 years old. I sat by the window, and I couldn't believe we were traveling so fast. I saw the poles along the roadside and the trees. There were more than flying by. You know, I don't know if we were traveling more than 25 miles an hour or something, but yeah, it was quite interesting for us younger kids. And, well, it led on, of course, as New Sweden kept growing, and cars increased, and before we knew it, we had almost every family had a car. The old Model Ds were prominent, of course. Some bought cars from outside, and some bought some old used steamers that they brought up and had for cars. And, it's quite a collection of cars. And then, of course, first thing we knew, the airplanes were coming in, and then that was something to see. So I can remember the first airplanes coming in, and, well, as World War I came on, too, and things were quite upset during the war, but then the boys came back, those that were in the service, and some of these flyers come back, that like Shaw and Cabby George Shaw, he had an army plane, he was doing stunt flying and at fairs and different Napoleon flag areas, they always had these airplanes doing stunts and falling leaves and I don't know what they call it, all loop-de-loops, and we couldn't believe it hardly that it could be done. Then of course, all the more improvements came up, like radio came, we had the first radios, I can remember those. As things progressed, and that was something out of this world, and we'd sit up and listen to programs from a little microphone on the set. I had one set in my living room, and I spent whatever evening getting programs, and every station, every call letter, and where they were located and everything. And then it got to be, so you had a console radio with the big speakers and quite an improvement, but then all of a sudden we got the TV came in. So then everybody got going on TV, and now, of course, that's the common thing. All our news and information comes mostly on TV nowadays. So I feel a lot of things have happened over my lifespan of 78 years, and even traveled to the moon, which was something we couldn't hardly believe, that space flights would be successful and place men on the moon. So I think that during our generation, we have just about seen the fastest progress, I think, in the country. So, 70 years. We better switch that off.
When the DNA came through here, Mr. Anderson, how much difference did it make in the community?
Well, of course I was quite young at the time, but it wasn't long before buildings and business places were built up down at the railroad station. We always called it the DNA station, this area. And the first store I can remember was Hamburg and Pearson was built down there, and then Peter Gungren built a store at a nice big grocery store, and then Master Tibbetts built a nice hardware store and ran a few years, and it was sold to Aaron Anderson. He ran that for many, many years, had all kinds of hardware and power machinery, and the other grocery stores were all doing a good business, and the jungle store was taken over by Turnquist from Caribou. They had a meat supply outlet there, and that was quite an improvement. And these continued on, and so B&A kept increasing in buildings more than the other part of the town at that time. New Sweden otherwise was centered around the capital and down towards the Alvik Mill, and where people were working more. And so that it made quite a change after the railroad came in. And then when we got the AVR railroad come in, then of course we got the garages and another store. Mr. Soderberg put up a store there which was run for many years. And then John Blomstrand used to, at the time that the old factory company was discontinued, he run this grocery store for many years, and so we had the two stores down there and garage and a couple of garages, I guess, at one time. And the B&A had a big Ford sales and service, which continued on for many years until the cars got so remodeled and knew that they all seemed to move into Caribou for it. But a big auto distributor down there took over the business, and the small individual business up here had dropped out.
I was thinking a few minutes ago when you were talking about the farmers. Were the Swedish farmers any more eager, any less eager to adopt new ways of farming than the other farmers around, do you think?
No.
For the new machinery, were they eager for the latest? Or?
No, they'd adopted to almost as fast as the growers around the potato growing sections like Caribou, and it seemed to keep up with this type of advance as machinery came in, and from hand hoeing to hand spading and hand cultivating to riding cultivators, and from riding cultivators to went into double hoes and riding hoes, and they all had that, same as the big growers. And The only change that happened was when the tractors came in. In fact, at one time all the New Sweden farmers had their tractors too and discontinued horse-drawn equipment, so...
They weren't more cautious than the other farmers.
The tractor farmers?
The Swedish farmers.
Well,
were
yes, they were really quite prosperous. They had done very well. They were, of course, conservative people, and they were good potato growers, and they were really... At one time, there was very few places that had any mortgage on them. They were all paid up, and they had money in the bank. And New Sweden was, out of Kepler, considered a very prosperous community, and a lot of... saving deposits in the banks in Kebbo. They claimed that when the banks closed in Kebbo, the Rooster Trust was partly opened by the Swedish depositors down there, that they had a large amount of savings. But these later years, well, of course, it's been changing a lot, and the potato farming with bigger equipment didn't work out so well. When you get into double planters and larger tractors and that, they couldn't compete, so they dropped out until we only have a few farmers left now. But even now the big growers are dropping out because they can't make any money at potato growing. So I don't know what's going to happen eventually.